Hi, and welcome to the Strad Podcast. I'm Davina Shum, I'm a cellist, and I'm the online editor at the Strad. Many of us as string players will find ourselves teaching in one way or another throughout our careers. We learn and pass on this great legacy of tradition that has gone before us. But what else informs our teaching? How do we find our groove, so to speak, as teachers and players? Cellist Guy Johnston spoke with me about finding his teaching style, particularly after returning to his alma mater, the Eastman School of Music in Rochester. What's it like returning to the hallowed halls of your former school, where you now call your former teachers colleagues? Guy shares his aha moments of inspiration that he brings into his teaching, as well as his journey to delve into the wealth of teaching resources left to us from cello pedagogues of the past. Guy, welcome to the Strad Podcast. It's wonderful to have you here today because you're no stranger to readers of the Strad or indeed thestrad.com. A little bit about you, as I mentioned before, going to awkwardly say some biographical information to your face. So you were a student at the Eastman School of Music in Rochester in New York, and then you actually returned years later as associate professor, you know, coming back to your alma mater. I can't help but think of the phrase full circle. And then, of course, later this year, you're preparing to move back to the UK. You know, you've recently taken up the role of president of the European String Teachers Association and also continuing a visiting professorship role at Royal Academy of Music. So we're here today to talk a little bit about your pedagogical approaches and teaching methods that you fall back on. I think it's fair to say that there is a lot of pedagogical resources out there, so it's easy to feel overwhelmed. So my first question for you is, do you have any particular nuggets of wisdom that you discovered when you returned to your alma mater as an associate professor at Eastman?
Yeah, I mean, initially it was a very strange moment because I just had all these memories of being a student. And in fact, I'm teaching maybe five doors up from where I used to study with Stephen Doane and Rosie Elliott. And I remember walking to my studio for the first day of sessions and rather surreally almost walking past the door as if I was going for my own lesson. Yeah, it's been an extraordinary moment for me. It's been 6 years that I've been teaching here, and an opportunity really to reflect on my past and what perhaps I might tell my younger self today. Mm. I've just been forced to really think afresh in new ways about teaching, about looking at music in a new way, or continuing on from what I've obviously discovered in the past. But I think that the students have surprised me and pushed me with their questions and with their own searching that has sort of caused me to almost reevaluate myself and basically find a whole new road of discovery here.
Mm. How do you feel like you'd, because obviously there were several years between you attending as a student and then, you know, attending as a professor. What do you feel like had changed in between? It might seem like a bit of a silly question, but how do you feel like you'd developed as a cellist or in your teaching approaches during that time that sort of informed your arrival as a teacher?
Yeah, I mean, I think I'm very much trying to balance my performing and my teaching. The role at Eastman has been much more, shall we say, full-time with 16 students, as opposed to when I was in London and concertizing a lot throughout the year and teaching at the Royal Academy of Music. I only had a very small class, so I was very much juggling. The focus was on performing, and then teaching was always there, but not as focused as it's been in more recent time. I think, obviously, you learn when you're performing. You need to be on stage to really learn and grow, and the ups and downs of a performing life, and really take that energy into the studio. So if I was teaching all the time, I don't think I would be as useful as if I'm getting the experiences to then draw upon those and use that in my teaching as well. And of course, the teaching then informs when I go on stage, because, you know, I have to live by example. I have to make use of what I'm using in the studio on stage.
Yeah, it's definitely a two-way thing, isn't it? I mean, you've got to have that experience of your performing so that you can help give that insight to your students. And then do you find sometimes that you say something in your teaching and you think, my goodness, I sound exactly like my teacher, or my teacher used to say that to me?
You know, when I first came back here, I very much had Steve Doan, you know, I'm often quoting him in my lessons here. And often actually with fingerings and bowings, I say, oh, yes, Mr. Doan gave me that fingering. It was almost like a sort of stamp of approval that if in case the student for a moment doesn't agree with the solution, I can say, well, it, you know, it was passed on to me. And of course, it is an oral tradition. And I have all my teachers, you know, Stephen Islis and David Waterman from the Endelian Quartet, Ralph Kirschbaum, Bernie Greenhouse. I do quote them all at different stages, and it surprises me when they're sort of, they're all sitting on my shoulders, you know, and I'm indebted to them. But I think what I've had to do is, rather than just sort of be a mediocre example of all of them, I kind of needed to find my own way of teaching. And that might have also been a sort of cultural thing, being British in an American school. And of course, there's international students here. And of course, a lot of Europeans came to America. And it's hard to say that there's one school of teaching here and a different one. And it's very much a global style, I think. The reading materials that I've gone through in the time I've been here, which was sort of sparked by COVID, actually, when we suddenly had more time, I've found nuggets of information that I've heard maybe before, those wonderful aha moments. But I've also found new things. You know, your instincts are honed by the knowledge that you build up. And it's hard to say where it's come from sometimes, but I just find that through reading and listening and absorbing all this material, that somehow that then shapes and informs the way that you share information with others.
Mm. And then sometimes these resources, these written resources that we perhaps keep revisiting, we keep coming back to, it's almost like as you progress through your career, different parts jump out at you, you know, depending on what your experiences have been. There might have been something that you would have skimmed over earlier on in your career, and then later on you're like, oh gosh, that's such a light bulb moment. I mean, I think in my experience there were times where I had lessons with particular teachers and I'd still be thinking about what they had to say weeks and weeks later. You know, it was kind of the gift that kept on giving. So I mean, that's kind of, you know, where we're heading now, talking about all these different resources and stuff, but the legacy of these treatises and things that are written down, they kind of do keep giving, don't they? I mean, can you share some examples of some of your favorite resources that you perhaps discovered, rediscovered, or started exploring, as you mentioned before?
Yeah, I mean, I've always been reading in a way when I think back, but more so in recent years. And when I first got back to Eastman to teach, of course, I turned to my old mentor, Stephen Doan, and I said, you know, if there were some books I should get right now, what would you recommend? And we went through a bunch of reading materials, including Morris Eisenberg's Cello Playing of Today, which, of course, he was a student of Casals. Zen in the Art of Archery by Herigel, do you say? I'm trying to remember the name of the writer now, which was another way of looking at things from another angle completely. And I've been through Alexanian. He was one of the earliest treatises, I suppose, from 1922. Totele, How I Play, How I Teach. Mm. And, you know, the list goes on. I'm looking at the books right now. I then went into Galamian and the Principles of Violin Playing, William Pleas' cello book, and so on. And it's just sort of basically, I've got this library of books that have gone into music, into pedagogy, but also into psychology, which really interests me. So trying to understand as much about who we are is as important as playing the cello. Of course, it's a major part of playing the cello. And in fact, Christopher Bunting most of these manuals seem to connect to Casals. And of course, Casals changed the world of cello playing. And so I see all these connections and threads between what I've read and how they connect in some way. And that's really fascinated me. Yeah, Christopher Bunting was just, I never met the man, but in fact, I've never met any of these past cello gods, if you like. But yeah. I feel like I've got to know them somehow. But he's very entertaining in his two volumes of, he talks about the left side and the right side of playing. And it's just very amusing. But he was the one who really said, really, students need to find out first about themselves before they even play a note. Yeah, there's so many nuggets of information in all of those. It's hard to sort of pick right now. I've been actually kind of going back over some of them and writing down quotes. I make a lot of markings in my books so that when I reference them, and maybe one day I can make use out of them, just to get that inspiration, because actually we're sort of isolated a lot of the time in a practice room or a studio, and to have this information at our fingertips, suddenly you don't feel alone, and you're in this sort of wonderful dialogue and this sort of creativity that just becomes so infectious and endless. You just can't get enough of it, you know.
Yeah, I mean, it's like you're in a community, an elite group of these cello gods from the past, as you mentioned. But it can seem quite overwhelming, right? You know, so how do you sift through the information? I mean, there are a lot of books and stuff out there, and particularly when you're teaching students to find themselves, how do you go about getting them to do that? What sort of things do you suggest for them to do? Because I guess a lot of the time students are turning up to their lessons and they're worried about what fingering to employ for that last variation in Rococo Variations or something. But then you also need to be like Yoda-like Zen in their lessons and tell them you've got to find your own way, but that might not be what they want immediately. You know, how do you go about guiding them in that direction?
It's such a balance, isn't it? And it's sort of overwhelming, the fact that there's so much information.
Yeah.
And of course, it takes time to absorb all of that. But you take the stuff that is useful at any given moment, and that's so different from one person to the next. So I learned pretty quickly that in teaching style and methods, you can't apply the same to every student. You have to adapt. And I think that it depends what day it is, you know, what side of the bed they've got out of. And what's going on, because it's very busy. There's a lot of demands on the students here. They have their academic classes as well as the cello studies. And so really, I try and enter into each session, you know, I want them to play something to show what they've been working at through the week. And then I first ask, you know, do you have any questions? So try to find out what's perhaps on their minds. Mm-hmm. And then that can help to open up the possibilities for the session. But of course, the session really depends on the give and take, the push and pull, the way that the student is responding and where I'm at as well in the day. And of course, you can always be put in the right mood if you feel the energy from the student and that they've really given everything over the last week for this moment. And it becomes a sort of improvisation. The sessions that go incredibly quickly are the successful ones.
Yeah,
I've just found that there have been moments when I've been able to dig out a bit of information and give it to the student. I might send them a mass email with a quote that I've just read to inspire them for that day. I at one point I did one, I think, every day of the week, and I thought that was too many, so we did one a week. And then there's a green board in my room, and actually at the moment we've got good old Mr. Popper up on the green board, because it was so empty for so long, and I just thought, well, I need to write something on there. So I put his three major concerns are musical interpretation, to have an articulate technique, and a conscious effort to produce tonal beauty. And you want to try and find as simple as possible message that one can take away. And perhaps in their own time, once they see how much I get out of reading these manuals, they'll go away and in their own time find a way to do that. And of course, there's a point where you can be oversaturated and there's too much of the same thing. And actually, I'm glad that I've been through the process of reading these manuals and putting them away and now moving on to things in performance practice and other novels and other things. But I felt that there was very much a gap in my development that I, from a very young age, when I was a student here at Eastman, I won a competition, and that propelled me into the limelight, into performance opportunities, which was great. And of course, you're fearless when you're young. But there's a lot of stuff that needs to be, you know, talent can get you so far, but the work and the kind of conscious the thinking that goes on and the learning that needs to happen, you can't underestimate. So I would say that I feel like it was meant to be to come back here and to kind of really absorb and put myself into this world in the time that I've had, because I've needed it as much for myself as for the student.
Full circle, as I said before.
Yeah, exactly.
And it's filling in the gaps, isn't it? Because, you know, Casals famously said at the age of however old it was, that when asked, why do you still keep practicing? And he said, because I feel like I'm making progress. We're always filling in the gaps in our knowledge, even if you think, well, you can never really think you know everything about music, can you? So there's always something to explore.
Basically, for me, one thing has led to another, and I felt the need to understand the history and the legacy of the instrument and to understand where we've come from, where we are now, and where we're trying to get to. It is an extraordinary thing.
It's very three-dimensional in that way. Yeah, and coming up with your own set of commandments, in a way, or mantras. We talk so much on this podcast about trying to get students to teach themselves, you know, make the role of you as a teacher redundant eventually. And so it's providing that more well-rounded education that goes beyond just technique or the notes or keeping up an orchestra, I guess, so that you have something to say in your music making eventually.
Exactly. And I think, you know, teaching and the students just keep your curiosity and your this adventure alive. Mm-hmm. You know, there's no point in keeping all this information to yourself. You have to, you know, part of the joy is being able to share things. And I get a real buzz out of seeing the students' eyes sort of light up when they've discovered something new.
Yeah.
And that's like me re-experiencing that, you know, and it carries an energy with it. And I think this sort of life force of cello and who we are is all just what keeps us up, you know, gets us up in the morning.
Yeah. Well, cellists, we're part of a big global family, aren't we? So what's the point of keeping it to yourself? I feel like we could talk about this forever. Just finally, do you want to just talk a little bit about what's next for you coming back to the UK, what your aims are pedagogically?
Back to funny England in home sweet home. Yeah, I mean, we you know, being a father, our daughter's now 2.5 years old. When I think about what I came out to America with and what I'm going back home with, I've picked up a few things along the way. And the most extraordinary of all is our daughter, Jaquetta. And she's fascinated when I'm playing away and she comes over and tries to grab my Stradivarius cello and talk bow, and I'm having to sort of put my leg out. We actually eventually found a blue foam cello that she can throw around. It doesn't make a noise,
but great.
It has these sort of track marks on. You put this wooden stick in between, and it's as if she's bowing and playing, and I'm playing along with her. It's just so much fun.
That's cute.
And that, of course, makes me reimagine what it is like, all these senses and these sensations and everything. And when she's touching the wood and feeling the vibrations and things like that. So, you know, it's been an unbelievable journey. I have since got a Stradivarius cello, this tour bow, which happened whilst I was here. Mm. All this reading material, new music repertoire I've been learning. And when I get back to England, I think initially the idea was to have a sabbatical, but then I couldn't imagine just stopping. And I was a bit afraid of just not having anything in the diary. So I do have a lot of concerts and plans. I'm joining a piano trio that's part of the new Bechstein Hall.
Oh, right, yeah.
And I'm playing some concertos. I've got a new cello concerto being written, and I'll be doing some guest teaching at the Royal Academy of Music. And just keeping active, my role with Esther, we're going to be brainstorming about some thoughts for the future. Mm-hmm. I've got this bug in me. I've got to keep going. And but I think it would be great at some point to reflect, once I've got home, on America, and perhaps even somehow put all these things that I've picked up in one place, and perhaps help me to just organize my thinking even more and put this chapter behind me and moving on again.
Yeah, how fascinating to be able to look back on that part of your life from the other side of the Atlantic. And I think we should start a petition to have your cello nicknamed the Stradivari ex Jaquetta sometime in the future. But anyway, I thought I'd wrap things up now. But Guy, thank you so much. It's been a pleasure.
Thanks, Davina. It's been great. Thank you.
That was Guy Johnston. Guy's very kindly shared a list of his favourite resources, which we'll put up on thestrad.com. So we'll put a link to that in the show notes if you're interested. And why don't you let us know what your favourite teaching resources are? As Guy said in our chat, there's no point keeping it to yourself. Part of the joy is being able to share things. You could even share this episode or share this podcast with your circles, which leads me to the seamless segue that is, don't forget to check out thestrad.com, where you'll find the latest news, articles and reviews on all things to do with string playing. If you like what you see and hear, register and subscribe to access exclusive archival content from 2010 onward. There's 50% off an online subscription for students. If you're not sure you're ready to subscribe, take out a free trial for 7 days, start reading right away with no strings attached. And if you happen to be on Apple Podcasts right now, give us a review or a rating. It will help other people discover this podcast. Thanks for listening. Tune in again soon for another episode. Take good care. Bye.